in-depth conversations with those that got some things going on within the Black community. And let's not forget about all of the plentiful activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Welcome to another episode of the Environment in Canada podcast, a podcast about the environment in Canada by Sierra Club Canada. I'm Jessica, Sierra Club Canada's Ontario Director. February is Black History Month, and so to bring light and amplify Black stories within the environment, today I'll be speaking with Juliet Rennick, who is our board secretary at Sierra Club Canada Foundation. Juliet grew up in Kenya, and today we talk about her immigration into Canada, Canada's Black history, the work of Wangari Maathai, who was instrumental in inspiring Juliet's own work as a Black environmental activist, and some ideas on how to be a supportive ally. Before we begin, just a reminder that you can take action on environmental issues by visiting sierraclub.ca. We have tons of petitions, other actions and events, and regular new updates you can sign up for on the homepage. You can also find Sierra Club Canada on social media, and you can listen to the Environment in Canada podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to click follow or subscribe so you get the latest episodes from us. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation with Juliet Rennick. Hello and good afternoon, Juliet. I'm so glad that we get to have a conversation today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I just wanted to get started with first learning more about you. So maybe you can tell our listeners about who you are, what brought you to Sierra Club Canada, and what you're up to these days. Like, what's the work that you do?
I'm Juliet Rennick. I'm the board secretary at Sierra Club Canada. Also new to Canada, well, relatively new. I'm 5 years in Canada now. I'm originally from Kenya, and I've always been very interested in environment and sustainability. I've worked with communities that have faced climate change, that have had to adapt to climate change back in Kenya. And here in Canada, I have worked with a few nonprofits in the environmental sector, and I just love being associated and affiliated with Sierra Club Canada. I believe in the vision and the mission. That's me in a nutshell.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you. I would love to learn more about the communities that you worked with in Kenya.
Yeah, so in Kenya, I worked with communities based in the northern part of Kenya. These are communities who are exposed to very harsh climates, it's very hot there. They've had to adapt to long periods of no rains, droughts, and adapted to planting drought-resistant crops. They also are exposed to, with climate change, they're also exposed to war in terms of fighting for the limited resources. So these are areas that are also not very safe, not very secure. And these communities have had to adapt. Yeah, there's a lot there.
I'm sure that could be an entire conversation all in itself.
Yeah, true.
Oh, okay. So yeah, part of why I really wanted to have this call at this time is because, as we know, February is Black History Month. And so I wanted to know, kind of on a personal level, what does Black History Month mean to you? And of course, acknowledging that there is so much inherent diversity within Black history, mm-hmm. and that a lot of the perspective or kind of knowledge coming out of it will vary depending on really the lineage that each person is from, right? Whether you're born in Canada, whether your ancestors were forcibly brought over. So that I guess I really want to welcome you to tell kind of your personal story. Like, I'm aware that we're aware that it's a complex in some ways because there's just so many different aspects of it. But I'd be very curious to know how you relate to Black History Month yourself, especially as a kind of, I don't know if you identify as one, but as a Black environmental activist or someone working in that space.
Yeah. So, like you said, Black history is diverse. And I believe that celebrating Black History Month has to include all the individual Black history. As a new Black Canadian, I would have to acknowledge the history of those who came before me here in Canada and what they've been through. And that also helps to shape the narrative of Black history and Black environmental activism here in Canada. We would not have Black history here in Canada if we didn't acknowledge like Black culture from way back in Nova Scotia, dating years back. And we all know like what, and if we don't know, it's something we would be open to learning about, like what happened in Africville in Nova Scotia. These are historical things that happened that have shaped the narrative to accommodate Black Canadians who are new to Canada as well. Like we find that as Black Canadians who are new to Canada also experience some form of racism. Some do, some don't. Like people have different stories, depending also on why they came to Canada, whether it's economic reasons or being refugee immigrants. And we're talking about like housing situations. We're talking about access to green parks. We're talking about energy poverty. And we also talk about inclusion in consultation to policies that affect the communities that they live in, and participation. And also we talk about leadership, opportunities for leadership in different organizations that represent Black communities in Canada. For instance, my story, being new to Canada, like looking at what organizations I would like to be affiliated to, the first thing I would do is look at the leadership of the specific organizations, like, is the leadership inclusive? How is their board, like their managers, are they inclusive? Or do they just say that, oh, we are all inclusive to different races, gender and everything, but that's just in writing, but not exactly what they do. And that also speaks to tokenism, where sometimes you find that Black people are like, they're there just for the visual representation, but not really like to be seen and not to be heard. Yeah. So this is some of the things that I can think of at the top of my head. And again, this is a very deep topic and very, very specific to different individuals, and cannot really be, it's not really something that can fit under an umbrella.
Sure. Like,
this is what it means to be Black in Canada. Again, we have different, like Black history in Canada is composed of different cultures from the Caribbean to different parts of Africa and different parts of the world, and the settlers who are here in Canada for centuries before we came, that all has to be put into consideration when we talk of Black history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a good reminder for sure. I wanted to go back actually before we kind of get too far ahead, just in case some of our listeners don't know what happened in Africville or what even the context is behind that. Could you maybe kind of go back to that and kind of give us a general overview as to like why the significance of the East Coast, what was Africville, what kind of happened, and how it kind of affected your maybe immigration coming over, and how it might have influenced your decisions, and how you feel like you might belong to a new country.
Okay. So Canada takes pride in the history of the Underground Railway, but the country also has a history of slavery for over 200 years. The history lives on in anti-Black racism in Canada to date. So like I said earlier, it's difficult to talk about Black history without acknowledging Black communities that were displaced from their homes in Africville, Nova Scotia in the 1960s. These are communities that had lived there for years, for like they built their home, they were paying taxes, like they, and they did this to have a a sense of belonging, but they were not, the city did not provide services for them, like services like sewage, access to clean water, garbage disposal. These are things they were not provided for. And then the city, instead of providing these services, the city decided to forcefully evacuate them. That was not the right response. And without including them in like consultation and getting their point of views, having them participate in decisions of where or how they would have wanted that to be handled. They also faced a lot of indignity. Dorothy Carey was moved. I think she was among the last people who were forcefully moved from her home in a city of Halifax garbage truck. Like the indignity of it all. She cried. She didn't want to. It's just sad. Like, it's one thing to lose your home. It's another thing to not even know where you're going to be relocated to. These are communities that were forced in to lose their culture, their identity. Some were compensated, some were not, and some to this date are still fighting for compensation.
Wow.
And it's just really sad. Those who could prove that they had title deeds to their homes got compensated. A lot could not. Like they lived in family homes that they had lived in for years and had no way of proving that. And they, I think they would just spend like $500 and like, hey, here, now go on your way. Wow. or forced to leave to receive government subsidies. Like that was just unfortunate, and it's indignity. Like, you're subjecting people to something that they didn't choose to, and purely because of the color of their skin. And not just that, like where most of these families were relocated to, they were not exactly welcome, because the people they found there believed they were inferior to them. Mm-hmm. So like they wanted these families out. So here you are, evicted from your home, and you're not wanted elsewhere, and it's all for the color of your skin. No one chooses to be born how they're born. So these are historical narratives that have shaped the identity of Black culture to date. And there will always be that question of, am I going to be welcome? Am I going to fit in? For me, and I believe for all other immigrants who come to Canada, and they're like, how will I be treated because of the color of my skin? Will they consider what I bring to the table, my knowledge, or will all that be, or will I just be judged by how I look and not what I have to give? So it's unfortunate, but that's how history helps to shape our future. So that's unfortunate what happened in Nova Scotia. The city of Halifax offered an apology. Some families accepted the apology, but some did not. Like, it was just so difficult. And this comes down to a personal choice. When something happens to you, you have every right to choose how you will want to deal with it. So that goes to just show like how the history then still shapes the narrative to date. We have cities that have chosen to act. I believe most cities have chosen to actively participate and be all inclusive. Cities like the city of Toronto, very popular with public participation of Black communities and communities living in low-income neighborhoods to get their opinions that will shape policies and decisions made that affect the people living in those communities.
I want to pause you there for a second. Where do you live again?
I live in the city of Kitchener, but I'm back in Toronto.
Okay, got it.
I'm actually new to Kitchener. I've lived in Toronto since I came to Canada.
Okay, fascinating. Yeah, because I'm in Toronto, but I find it really interesting that your perspective on Toronto is that this kind of sense of like public participation in Black communities, because as an example of Little Jamaica, as the LRT has been expanding through Eglinton, That's definitely one pocket where there's been a lot of upset in the Black communities there, feeling like they weren't consulted and there wasn't real public consultation or real regard as to whether, you know, their businesses would survive, you know, during that, I don't know, like, I don't, maybe it's been 7 years of construction and a lot of them haven't. And so there is this ongoing conversation of maybe a segue into what environmental racism is and what I think it is such a quite a new term. Maybe we could switch gears and kind of touch on that.
Actually, you're right. You're very right. And that's also an example of modern day environmental racism. It's one thing for the city to conduct public participation, but how they conduct it might not be probably the best way or all inclusive. And just like in anything, you cannot always do things 100%, but you can always learn. Yes, a lot of Black-owned businesses have been affected by the LRT, and that's also unfortunate. And I believe that that could have been done in a much better way. And that said, there are areas where the city has been actively involved in getting the community's opinion when it comes to public transit and putting up active transportation. The other thing is like Thorncliffe Park, for instance.
Yeah, they also had their issues with Metrolinx and the expansion of the LRT. And just to kind of speak to you saying that some neighborhoods that had gotten consultation, I mean, I personally was working in the West End of Toronto with Mount Dennis. And one of the challenges that they've come up with recently is exactly what you're talking about, this kind of like discrepancy in which neighborhood gets public consultation and which do not. And so as an example, when Metrolinx was building out the line, Etobicoke, which is an affluent area, and I would say perhaps lower in terms of their degree of diversity, was afforded a far more ability to lobby and to have their opinion heard and to really influence basically for the track to go underground. And so now you have a community where, you know, their storefronts are not affected by like the rumblings of a train, you know, like they can kind of preserve that look and feel. Whereas in Mount Dennis, where we're talking about a priority neighborhood that is has like a high proportion of single family homes, is really high levels of diversity in BIPOC communities. You know, if you ask them, no consultation whatsoever.
That's like very unfortunate.
Yeah, so it's interesting how, and this really does kind of speak to this concept of environmental racism and what that means.
Yeah. So I guess when it comes to public participation and consultation, there's still a lot of work that has to be done to ensure that equity in participation. Like, it's not just the high income neighborhoods who have the ability to lobby that get heard, and the ones that don't do not, or like the ones that are in low income neighborhoods with no ability to lobby do not have equal representation, and their opinions are not taken into consideration. And there's a lot that still needs to be done, for sure. That said, Toronto would still top most cities when it comes to public participation, and that speaks to how much work other cities in Canada need to do. I'd also like to talk about energy poverty. We have people living in low-income neighborhoods who suffer the most when it comes to energy poverty, and this means that they cannot really afford to heat their homes when it comes to very harsh climate, very cold weather. You have to decide whether you're going to either heat your home or put food on the table. That is a choice that no one really needs to have to make.
And where is this happening that you're speaking of?
Low income neighborhoods. Think of a lot of immigrant communities, refugees in areas like Jane and Finch, for example, who cannot afford to like heat their homes or the electricity bill. And it's just really unfortunate. And then that also speaks to safety. When you have low-income neighborhoods that are experiencing these kinds of problems, you expect these neighborhoods to not be safe. And which is really unfortunate. And then that just ends up being, it just ends up being like a whole lot of problem that the city has to deal with, and they have to find solutions for that. So things like affordable programs, it needs to be more accessible, education as well.
So how has your experience been coming to Canada and kind of being in a new country? Where did you come from?
I've lived in Kenya. I studied in Finland, and then I came to Canada.
What was your sense on coming into Canada as to, you know, racism exists kind of all over the world, right? And I'm just curious to know, I think I'm trying to get a sense of what it's really like for you. You know, when you alluded to kind of just like what sounds like coming into a space and really not knowing how you're going to be received, and kind of, I would imagine like that requires a bit of vigilance and being on guard. I'm just curious to know how you felt coming to Canada.
The thing with Canada, I would say, is still very accepting of immigrants and different people, different backgrounds. I came from Finland, which was also, I believe, like Scandinavian countries, and Finland that I can speak to did their part when it came to providing education, like their CSR to the world. And then Canada was and still is more welcoming. But also life in Canada is very expensive. So unless you have, if you're new to the country and unless you have a decent job, having, living in a decent kind of place is not exactly easy. I have family here in Canada. I'm married, so I wouldn't say that, again, my experience might not be exactly what everybody else has been through, but I do have friends or friends of friends who have had it really, really tough. Like have had to share homes, like big homes, and then you like you share rooms and you can barely make rent, and you live with the expectation of being kicked out anytime. And then there's also the aspect of you're internationally educated. So having to prove yourself that your experience and your education matches that of those educated and who have experience in Canada can be a very, very tough, very tough thing to navigate. That one I can say for a fact. And the other thing I've learned is that it's not all organizations or companies take into account lived experiences. Like there's more when you talk of college degrees and college diplomas, degrees, whatever, all that schooling, that's all fine. And it's good to have that. But there's also lived experiences that is unmatched. I don't think that's something that a lot of employers take into consideration. And you find that most people, immigrants, Black, you have your lived experience on top of whatever education you've brought in. And it becomes really tough to prove yourself and to outdo, because it's like a competition. You have to outdo the next person for you to get anywhere, and you're just trying to survive because you, at the end of the day, you want a paycheck to be able to have a roof over your head and heat your home, heat or cool your home depending on the weather. So that said, I guess I don't think. I did not really have it tough navigating here. Again, I had family holding my hand, but it's not always the case for people who have absolutely no relations and have to start from the very scratch.
I'm always so amazed whenever I do use like Uber or one of those kind of like driving drive share platforms that whenever I speak to the drivers, like I would say probably 100% of the time, it's been an immigrant. And hear their story of like how hard it's been transferring over. And oftentimes they're a doctor, they work in public policy, and they're just, you know, the credentials don't work over here. And yeah, it's just been really, really kind of shocking to me and almost kind of devastating, you know, like people kind of come over in hopes for a better future. And granted, there, I have also spoken to drivers who also are often BIPOC, you know, BIPOC individuals. You know, there are some that are very grateful for Canada because they're coming from such violent and impoverished places. And so there is both, like you say, but I'm always just so kind of empathetic towards immigrants that are new to Canada, because I think there's the kind of what your expectations were and there's like the reality. And I'm very happy to hear that yours was never too tough. So that's really good to hear.
No. Plus it also, well, I also moved here as a student before I settled with my family here. But the thing with also the jobs that are available, like you said, there's the Uber, there's the, so it depends with the type of jobs that one has in mind. And then there's the reality of the jobs that you can get. So that's the hard part, like navigating being new to Canada is a, not just as a Black immigrant, but really like as any immigrant, I would say an immigrant of color.
I want to kind of go back to your roots in Kenya and talk about kind of what inspired you to want to work in the environmental nonprofit field, like who inspires you?
So I have a business degree from Kenya, and I worked in the banking and insurance industry before I started working with this nonprofit that sent me to very vulnerable communities in northern Kenya. And that's where my love for the environment and understanding of what climate change does to communities that are vulnerable was born. That said, the late Professor Wangari Maathai is a very renowned Kenyan environmentalist. She also is a Nobel Prize winner. Her environmental activism just helped me to see there's more that we can do. And there's more that I can do. She's been a big influence. And like the legacy she started, it wasn't easy. It's never easy, like in a developing country. It's never easy, like just speaking your mind and holding on to what you believe is true. So she's been a very, her work has been very inspirational to date. Yeah.
And as far as I understand, she had a project called the Green Belt Movement.
The Green Belt.
I find that so funny because, you know, we have our own Green Belt in Ontario, but it's a very kind of different thing. So can you share a little bit more about that project?
She planted trees in the Green Belt Movement and faced political hardships and was able to round up women to actually get to do this. I believe at one time even threatened to strip naked because the government of like the government of the day was not very accommodating of her initiatives. But to this date, her efforts paid off and the Green Belt Movement still lives on. Tree planting has become a thing and her legacy still lives on from what she started and what her family is doing to keep it going. Yeah,
I did a little bit of research on the Green Belt Movement and I found it, I don't know why I either learned this and forgot it, but it really drove home to me how like when we plant trees, it actually brings the rain. And it's something that I don't think, maybe because we live in a city and we're kind of, we live separate to our food in some ways, you know, it's on a farm and, you know, I just don't have the same relationship as you might if you lived in rural areas. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just to kind of brought home to me the fact that in losing trees, we actually change our weather systems because then we don't draw rain. And of course, for, I think the communities she was working with, it meant whether or not you were going to have clean soil for good food and how, and really kind of organizing to plant trees that really changed the way communities were thriving.
Yeah. Well, and plus the science that we all know that trees take in the carbon dioxide, give off oxygen, just It just goes to show, like, you can't go wrong with planting trees. Like, it's a win-win, really. Yeah. So the only challenge would be having actual land to plant trees. Like, yes, they're emerging cities, and this emerging cities and urbanism are being experienced everywhere because of rising population. So there's that. So things like planting trees have to compete with spaces. Do we have enough spaces for that? Do we have areas allocated for that? Are there areas that are protected just for that? In Canada, we have areas that are protected, like they're just green spaces protected. There's that. But then you find that in places like in Kenya, there are forests that are supposed to be protected, but there's still illegal activities going on, like cutting down the trees for commercial purposes or settling in people. Those are some of our challenges that are being experienced there, and I believe are replicated in other parts of the world.
Sure. I mean, in some ways, Canada has a slightly even more complex history about conservation at present, at least, because you talk about in Kenya it being a legal activity, but here it's a bit more complex because in my perspective, what's been happening is that the government can actually rewrite the laws so that now it's legal to clear cut an old growth forest, for example, out in the West Coast. Or a premier can kind of make changes to the laws so that, oh, like maybe we'll expand the urban boundary, which actually equates to destroying the green space, right?
There's that.
So it's a kind of an interesting thing to see how legality kind of plays into conservation and what's effective and what isn't. Because when the laws change to make things what would originally be illegal to be legal, then we're kind of in like even more dicier waters.
And again, I guess that's where the government has to do a better job with their public consultation and participation. Like, the people who are going to be affected, communities living nearby or far, have they been consulted? What's their take on that? Or does the consultation only happen as a just as a like a mask of, oh yeah, we asked them for their opinion, but wouldn't really take into consideration what their opinion is.
Yeah, there's a quote by Wangari Maathai that I really, really liked. She said, "It must be the people who must save the environment. It must be the people who must make their leaders change. So we must stand up for what we believe in, and we cannot be intimidated." And I really loved that. And I think in this time where we can feel so disheartened, I think it's just to kind of like remember that the mechanism of like people speaking up and holding their leaders accountable and to not just stop talking about things can be incredibly powerful. I really loved that.
There's power of telling stories. That's one thing I've always believed in, and there's power in numbers as well. Sometimes we might underestimate the power that we have of speaking out. When you look at Wangari Maathai, despite everything and the era, like when she lived in and the era she lived in and when she started this activism, it wasn't easy. She spoke out, she did, and here we are, years later, still speaking, and her legacy living on. Yeah,
Yeah.
there's that too.
To my knowledge, she was arrested many times. Like, I think there's a story of her where she at some point was like even unconscious, brought to the hospital. But when she roused and was awake again, she's went back to doing exactly what she got arrested for because she really believed she was doing the right thing. And it was from that action and that way of living that she really inspired this whole community of women to kind of reclaim their, ability to show up and care about what they really cared about. And it's really, really beautiful.
Talk of a passionate leader and a leader who leads by action.
Yes.
What she was.
Yeah, not because she wanted to be popular or
Not
anything.
at all. No, I believe that was the last thing at the back of her mind. No, this was about having a dream, believing in something, and working towards it.
And I think she's also an incredible example of how the environmental and social movements can actually work so well together because oftentimes, like I'm a great advocate of like breaking down silos and really seeing the social movement and the environmental movement as like incredibly like holding hands. You know, it may be like the image of, you know, kind of like one wing of each bird, you know, like they're kind of, they need to be working in tandem, in my opinion. But a lot of times I get this pushback, like, oh, well, if we kind of buddy up with social issues, then the environmental case gets lost. And that way of thinking really makes me pause, because I really think that another way of seeing it is possible. And so it's wonderful to see her story and see how it was actually the act of tree planting that drew these women together. But it was just like a door opener, really, you know, it was an opportunity to start sharing ideas and getting organized and becoming a community that really, from my understanding, like really improved the quality of life for these communities. And as we know, oftentimes, like women are the ones that are also responsible for the food on the table and these family decisions, right? So when you help kind of empower a woman, you're also taking care of a family.
That cannot be truer what you just said. And especially in areas like rural Kenya, women are 150% responsible for everything. You wake up in the morning, you don't have running tap water, you have to go fetch water, you have to go till your land, you have to bring food home, prepare it, like you're everything from dawn to dusk. So yeah.
Was that your experience growing up, like living? No,
I grew up in Nairobi. I grew up in the city, but we used to visit rural, like my grandmother's place in rural central Kenya. And a lot of rural areas have the same shared experience. So you find that families have homes in the city, but always go back to the rural areas, like during Christmas or other holidays. 70% of Kenyans have experienced the rural setting. And with time it's become very modernized, but we still have areas that don't have running tap water or electricity, and you have to literally till your land to get food.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to kind of switch gears a bit in the rest of our conversation, talk a little bit more about, you talked about earlier about sometimes organizations can actually just be superficially committed to inclusivity, equality, and ensuring that the representation includes Black narratives and Black individuals. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to talk about tokenism as well as just kind of overarchingly, what does it mean to be a good ally? You know, like how does one, because, you know, out of BLM came a lot of like challenge where then some, let's for example say white folk felt like, okay, we want to be an ally. And then there was the, oh, well, I'm not here to teach you. So I would love, if you're open to it, to kind of share, I don't know if there's stories of that can kind of highlight things that don't go well and things that do go well and what your thoughts are about that.
Things that don't go well. And I actually learned this from one notable Black personality in the environment sector. Please, I wouldn't name their names, but they say that what one thing that really irks them, they hate it, is when there's an event or when it's February, because that's the Black
Lives
Matter. that's when everybody remembers to ask them, what's your opinion on this? Or could you come give us a talk about this? But all the other months, nobody asks them. So we have 12 months in a year. It's not just February that Black communities or Black environmentalists or have to have their opinions heard. No. Mm-hmm. So that is one thing that is very out there and that organizations could do better. And the other thing with being an ally is, before an organization decides or want to be an ally, they need to look at their inclusivity in terms of their hiring practices and their leadership as well.
Do they practice what they preach?
They practice what they preach.
Do they drink what they preach?
Do they drink water and preach wine? I don't know.
Better actually.
Yeah, but you get what I mean. Like,
yeah,
you, like we and also we have the a lot of companies, if not all in Canada, have the club. Like when there are job adverts out there, that we are all inclusive, against we don't discriminate race, what, all that. There's all that, but do they actually do that, or is that just something that's out there so that, hey, yeah, we are part of this and that's it. Mm-hmm. So for me, how their leadership is set up will speak to whether they're inclusive or not. How their hiring is set up, you can tell most companies by, like, they have the faces and the photos of whoever is involved there. You can tell by that. And I'm also speaking to organizations that mean well, but they don't have the right approach to this. And
Can you say more about what the right approach
right approach would be? This, other than just thinking of being inclusive in February and being inclusive all the other months of the year, they should also be open to approaching Black-led organizations for ideas. And like, for ideas, when we have Black-led organizations, like Black Environmental Initiative, Black EcoBloom, like, that's just for Black women, Black transgender, I'm sure these are organizations that they can partner with, or they can ask for opinions from or ideas from. Like, just don't shy away from asking. Mm-hmm. Don't, like, there has to be a conversation. Mm-hmm. Don't shy away from asking. Don't try to just employ one Black person there and then, here, we've done our part, or right. I don't know, like, there has to be a conversation. And I believe that's the right way to go about it. And then that said, there should also be, when it comes to conversations, there should also be an open space for opinions. Like, mm-hmm. You shouldn't feel bad for being Black or for being non-Black. Mm-hmm. The space should be open. You should not dim anyone else's candle, and you shouldn't dim yours to accommodate people. That's what I'm saying. There should just be an open conversation and be open to acknowledging what Black people are going through, or what they've gone through, or what and that is what equity is all about. That is where equity needs to start. There are also other resources out there, like documentaries, for instance.
And yeah.
Like, there's the Netflix documentary based on Dr. Waldron's book of...
Yes, it's called
There's Something in the Water. Yeah.
That one's a great one.
It is. So such documentaries or books, narratives, can help organizations understand history and where Black people are coming from, and that will help with the conversations going forward.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. I recently watched Stamped from the Beginning. Mm-hmm. I really found that so powerful. I was on the plane when I did it, and I was like weeping.
Oh, yeah. Very emotional.
Yeah, I was very emotional. And you're right, though, because it provided such a clear context, like, going into speaking to someone. Because as much as, like, you know, we all kind of have the same needs and kind of in some ways are very, very similar to one another, that historical context really can change, like, your nervous system, your capacity, you know, how safe you feel kind of on a general daily basis. Mm-hmm. And that then, like, helps us to be informed in terms of when we're meeting somebody from a different race, like, what they could possibly have lived through just through their ancestry and lineage, and having that extra level of compassion and understanding to, part of me wants to say, like, to kind of, like, meet them in that vulnerability, but also, like, just be having that compassion.
Compassion, yeah. Empathy, yeah. Mm-hmm. And here's the other thing. Remember when we started this conversation, I said that Black history is diverse?
Yes.
Even for me as a Black person, I don't have lived experiences of people whose ancestors or who were born here. So when I meet them, I have to be open. Like, I'm open to learning where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And And then they will also learn from where I'm coming from. My experiences from back in Kenya don't necessarily replicate to the experiences that they have living here. Mm-hmm. So that's just an example of how diverse Black history is and how open conversations can help create a safe space and somewhere to start.
This really speaks to kind of like our coming into meeting so-called strangers with this kind of presupposition or assumption of who they're going to be and what it would mean to kind of come to a conversation with being like, maybe, but I think I'm just going to remain open and find out.
Yeah.
And what that would feel like for everybody. Right. Cause I'm sure like I personally, my parents are from Hong Kong, but I would say maybe 90% of the time, everybody thinks I'm Filipino, and there's nothing wrong with being Filipino, but like, it always changes how people will talk to you based on what they think you are. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. They're those, like, we tend to judge people before we even know them. Like before we hear them, it's a case of judging a book by its cover kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we need to take time and open the first page, judge it after reading the last page. That is the approach that we should all have. When it comes to, again, Black history, we get judged by not just by our skin color, our last name, our accents, the jobs that you do. Like, it's very diverse, and it can be hurting, and it can also be eye-opening to what, as a society, you need to do and to move forward. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I really love what you're saying, because it kind of reminds me that Canada, yes, is so diverse. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, we're like seen as this like wonderful tossed salad, I think, rather than a melting pot, right? I think it's like the individual pieces in the salad are retaining their kind of uniqueness and difference. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I do think that there is, like you say, just so much work to be done to really be able to connect between all those different cultures and lived lineages.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think it's so like subliminal in some ways, how that happens.
Yeah. Like, we are as a black communities are more than just the color of the skin. There's different foods, different music, different beliefs. So, it's very diverse. It's, and all that has to be taken into consideration when we think of Black history and what Black history means to us. I think before moving to Canada, like, I knew of Black history back in Kenya, but like a North American concept. I don't believe we have Black history. Like, we have our own other history, like colonial history, and like celebrating that Black history, that's just big in North America. And I can see why, like, from the very painful history that the Black community went through. So that is also something that I'm learning and appreciating.
That's lovely. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're just about up for time, but I wanted to ask kind of like one last question in terms of, is there any sort of like Black-led environmental project or movement that you'd want our listeners to be aware of, or one that you'd want to see more support to go towards? So kind of just like a who you'd like to kind of call in to bring more light to.
So there's a I Breathe program.
I Breathe.
I Can Breathe program by the Black Environmental Initiative. They use citizen research projects to help community members get familiar with environmental problems in their communities and in the country. And then they also couple the citizen research activities with campaigns meant to promote the adoption of behavioral change in the community. I think that is one Black-led initiative, and that's the name of the organization that I really like. Like, I like what they do, and I also like Black EcoBloom, that's dedicated to Black women, Black transgender women, non-binary in the green sector. They provide access to resources, mentoring opportunities, education, and skills building. So I like what they do. There's so many more out there, but those two stand out for me.
Yeah, and I just want to make a quick shout out. I think it's Makeway that supports them.
Yeah, yes,
and, Makeway. I'm not sure if people know this, but is actually a child of Patagonia. So just so you know, some claps over there as well, because it's been, I think, I'm not sure if I've seen any kind of retail corporation gone, just take on so much spiritual like beauty to then be like, we're not going to be for profit anymore. All of our money is going to be going to, you know, and it's been funding kind of like democracy, you know, working on BIPOC issues. It's been just so inspiring to see that. So I wanted to just note that.
And then one last shout out to Black Environmental Alliance or Initiative Alliance. No, I forgot the actual name.
I think I've seen one called Black Environmental
Alliance. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. BEA is the one that I've seen.
It's just very encouraging to see all these Black-led organizations in the environmental space coming up and who've been there for a couple of years and still going strong in their projects.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to do my homework and make sure I reach out to them as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Juliet. It's been a real pleasure getting to know you and hearing your stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi there, Connor Curtis here, Head of Communications at Sierra Club Canada, just jumping in at the end of the episode to do the episode Q&A. This is a chance for our listeners like you to send in their questions to the podcast, and we try to answer them in as much detail as we can. These can be questions about the environment or about our work at Sierra Club Canada, and you can send your question in at communications@sierraclub.ca or find out more about the podcast at sierraclub.ca and contact us there with your questions. So this week, we're answering the question, why does Canada not have an effective investigative mechanism to constrain their overseas extractive firms involved in human rights abuses? And just to be clear, Canadian mining companies in particular are responsible for a lot of abuses overseas, human rights abuses, torture, the suppression of political dissent. It's important to point out the seriousness of what has been going on in that respect. But I'm assuming this question also has to do generally with extractive industries as well, in which case that's an even broader series of problems. And the simple answer to this question I am going to put out there is because it is probably inconvenient to those who make a lot of profit from those extractive industries. So a large proportion of the world's mining industries, for instance, are headquartered in Canada. I believe it's 60% are actually headquartered in Canada of mining companies. And that creates, of course, a lot of pressure on politicians and policymakers to maybe not go after those companies as strongly as we should. And as well, we've seen kind of repeatedly that Canada's legal system is not great at addressing environmental issues to begin with, and definitely not good when those issues are happening overseas and are something, however, that should be addressed as much in Canada as there, because these are Canadian companies. We've seen repeated failures by courts to deal with this issue in any sort of meaningful way, despite people coming forward with complaints about abuses overseas. So that is why we have such a problem holding those companies to account in Canada. I think that there are two other things that come to mind as well connected to Sierra Club Canada and what we do. So as you may be aware, you know, we're involved in a campaign against the international oil and gas projects of a Norwegian energy company called Equinor. And Equinor is proposing some really dangerous projects overseas. And more recently, we actually went to Norway to bring our concerns to the company and to Norwegians, who are ultimately the Norwegian government owns 67% of Equinor. And it's a very hard conversation to have because in that particular case, this company, which, you know, is threatening a lot of ecosystems, a lot of people's livelihoods overseas, not just in Canada, but in Argentina and Brazil and other places, this is a difficult conversation for people who are used to the idea that the company that represents them as a country is a positive force in the world. And I think we have the same problem here in Canada. And in a lot of ways, I could say, you know, Canada and Norway mirror each other in a lot of senses. We are both have economies that are heavily based on resource extraction. We both host companies that are involved in things overseas that are not great. And we both have trouble coming to terms with that. I think that's part of the other reason that it's an uphill battle in Canada to deal with the impacts of extractive industries overseas that are headquartered in Canada. And so there are a number of ways that we can go about that. I think that we do need to make legal changes in Canada so that, you know, there's more accountability to these companies, that they can be, in fact, charged in Canadian courts by international complaints about their actions, that not only to remember that, but also to remember, you know, some of these same extractive companies have done some pretty awful things in Canada as well, particularly against Indigenous communities in Canada. So there needs to be greater legal accountability. I think that politicians need to show more bravery in going after those companies. I think that's very safe to say. And I think this also ties into, in a broader way, some of the work that, you know, Sierra Club Canada does. So we can look at actually a couple of our campaigns right now. One, of course, is Bay du Nord and Equinor and going after an energy company elsewhere. But as well, if you'll recall, there's the Line 5 oil pipeline that is operated by Enbridge, a Canadian-based company that is operating a very dangerous oil pipeline through the United States, through Indigenous land, where they've been told by local authorities that they need to shut down that pipeline and refuse to do so. That Indigenous groups in the United States, just south of the border, have told them this is a violation of their rights to continue operating this extremely dangerous and outdated pipeline. And this is yet another energy company, a Canadian energy company in this case, an extractive company that is operating a project overseas in Canada's name and lobbied for in part by the Canadian government, that is theoretically representing Canadians, but is in fact doing a lot of harm and threatening the well-being of a lot of people in another country. That's a campaign that Sierra Club Canada is involved with, and it's a good example of, for instance, the sort of work that needs to be done in order to counter those sorts of actions by Canadian companies. But another part of Sierra Club Canada's work that we touched on in an earlier episode is this shift to a circular economy. And I think that inherently has a lot of benefits, not only for the environment, but in terms of helping to reduce the instances of abuse. Because I think one thing that's inherent to a sort of extractive-based economy is this notion of using resources and not replenishing them, going to other places and extracting and taking resources. And it's not to say that we won't ever be in a situation that we will not require any mining or any extraction of any kind, that those things will continue to some extent. But shifting things to a circular economy reduces a lot of the pressure off of our reliance upon extractive industries and helps to weaken the power of those industries over us. So there are things we can be doing economically in Canada to change things as well. There's the change of political will that 100% needs to happen. And there's also changes inside the court system. And if you look back on a lot of our work in the past couple of years, you know, it's been a bit of a face-to-face with that. We haven't done as much work directly on mining, but that is something that comes up, and it's something that's connected to all these other issues of extractivism and what we do with our economies and how we listen to voices, not just within Canada, but internationally. Because again, these issues are not, you know, just local issues. We work locally, but always in collaboration with people around the world. And I think that's another great thing that people can be doing, is listening to the voices of those who are affected, no matter where they are, and bringing those issues here locally in Canada to be heard here locally in Canada. Because I can tell you from working on other campaigns, being able to connect people to each other and to understand the commonalities of struggles, that is where we can build real resistance. So it's working locally, but with an international focus and with international communication and collaboration that can help us to deal with some of these abuses by companies. I hope that helps answer your question. And to those of you listening, please do feel free to send in a question. Once again, you can send your question in to communications@sierraclub.ca. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Environment in Canada podcast, a podcast about the environment in Canada by Sierra Club Canada. Just a reminder that you can take action on environmental issues by visiting sierraclub.ca. We have tons of petitions, other actions and events, and regular news updates you can sign up for on the homepage. You can also find Sierra Club Canada on social media, and you can listen to the Environment in Canada podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast also airs on CKUT Broadcast Radio in Montreal, 90.3 FM, bi-weekly on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. ET. Don't forget to click follow or subscribe so you get the latest episodes from us.
And you listen to CKT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Canada. So stay tuned all the time. Hear the greatest music. Hang in there.
Hace 25 años lo coronaron Rey del Reggaeton. Tres generaciones han bailado su música. Don Omar. Don Omar en su nuevo show Back to Reggaeton. Si se habla de reggaetón, hay que hablar del rey, Don Omar. The King is Back, domingo 17 de marzo, Montreal, Place Bell. Boletos a la venta por Ticketmaster. Produce CMN.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
This is why we had. Secret station never had. 90.3 ever had. Why? Why? This is why we had. This is why we had. Secret ever had. 90.3 ever had. Why? Why? The girls have love it, so they know that so we had. We listen to this station, this station well had.
This is Junior Reed, and when I'm in Montreal, I stay tuned to C-Cut 90.3 FM. Montreal, stay alive. The music.